right. Good morning, everyone. The first case we have up this morning is case number 77652, Snodgrass versus Bango Oil. Okay. Is everybody ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, great. So, Mr. Paulsenberg, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to save 4 minutes for rebuttal.
4 minutes, okay. As you well know, the clock will keep going after 4 minutes, so that's on you to pay attention.
I'm keenly aware of that.
Perfect.
Lily, can we get him any louder? Dan's? Mr. Paulsenberg's microphone, can we get this louder?
Okay. Let's work on that before we get started then. I assume it's folks in Vegas that need to do that?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Justice Kadish. I just was having a little bit of trouble,
sure.
A little bit of trouble hearing him.
I don't know. I've never had trouble hearing Mr. Paulsenberg, so I don't know.
I know. I'm sure that in the nicest possible way.
Absolutely.
Is this any better?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much.
And I have laryngitis, so that might be part of the problem.
Well. Okay. All right, go ahead and proceed now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. Dan Paulsenberg for the appellant, Daniel Snodgrass. The district court erred in granting summary judgment in this case for at least two different reasons. The district court reasoned that a landlord does not have a duty when it comes to premises, only the occupier or the tenant does. And the court also said if there was a duty, common law or statutory, especially statutory, the party or the landlord and the tenant had contractually delegated that to the tenant. Both of these are wrong, and there are other wrong issues. Well, we're looking at a duty. My primary argument is that the landlord had a duty on these premises because they are highly hazardous and explosive. Under NRS 459.3829. And that puts a duty on the owner or operator to maintain appropriate permits. Now, the permits were not obtained here. And if they had been,
Mr. Paulsenberg, let me interrupt you for just a sec. Under NRS 459.3829, when I read that statute, it talks about that the owner or operator can't commence construction or operation of a process subject to regulation unless they obtain the permits. Is there some evidence that Bango Oil commenced construction or operation of a new process?
And that is the respondent's linguistic argument. And honestly, I have a couple of problems with it. You know, there are revolutionary new ways to take textualist approach to statutes, and that's to figure out both what the legislature meant and what ordinary language would mean. And we go through in our briefs analyzing dangling participles and all forms of speech. But you have to remember, first of all, owner or operator is in here twice. And it has not so much to do with who is allowed to commence construction or who is allowed to commence operation. The critical phrase is further in the paragraph where it says, essentially, nobody can do anything unless the owner or occupier first obtains all appropriate permits. So the duty to obtain permits as the condition premises, a predicate to anything else happening, is on the owner or occupier. Now, a respondent makes fun of me by saying I use the word or to mean and, but that, I have a great legislative history argument for that, but honestly, if you look at just the phrase, nobody can do anything unless the owner or occupier obtains a permit, makes clear that the duty is on both of them. One of them has to do it. Now, their argument is essentially...
Well, possibly, based on the actual language of the statute, it's whoever's commencing construction or operation of a new process.
I don't think so, Your Honor. It could say, well, first of all, I don't agree that that or means only one of them. I think owner or occupier throughout 459 and also through the federal statutes on which Chapter 459 is based. The federal courts have always interpreted owner or occupier in circumstances like these to be a duty on both of them jointly. But really, if you're looking at the first phrase, that's also joint. If we paraphrased Shakespeare in Hamlet to say, no borrower or lender be, Shakespeare isn't saying, well, you can be one or not the other. The duty on both of them is joint, and the duty is to obtain a permit. So I think that goes further on. And I think that's clear not only from the federal cases, but also from the purpose behind Chapter 459. But the federal laws that we're dealing with here are the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, the RCRA, and also CERCLA, C-E-R-C-L-A. The Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Life. There, and these are the predicates to Chapter 459. These are the bases for Chapter 459. Now, respondent comes in and says, well, those have to do mostly with waste. And the parts of the statute, 459, that we're dealing with here don't have to do with waste. But it's throughout I think it's the predicate to the entire statute that owner or occupier is a joint duty. I understand.
So do they both have to get a permit, or just like what's going to happen?
One of them has to, but one of them, the owner can't say, oh no, the duty is only on one of us. So I think the duty should have been on the operator. And since the operator didn't do it, it's the operator's problem. No, if the operator doesn't do it, the owner has to do it. And that's particularly acute in the situation here. And this ties in with the district court's second analysis, which is that the parties had delegated it to only one of the parties. No, these two parties were both deeply involved. This isn't simply a situation where the tenant decided to make improvements to the property. These were contractually obligated. The relationship between the landlord and tenant is found in the agreement. First of all, the tenant was obligated to build these facilities. It was obligated to deliver a set of as-built plans and the permits to the landowner. It was obligated also to indemnify and obligated to make sure the permits didn't lapse. This isn't a situation where there is a remote situation between the two of them. Both of them are involved in this almost as a joint operation. And so under those circumstances, first of all, the landlord knows that there have to be permits, knows that it's supposed to review the plans, because it's supposed to review the plans and the permits and have them delivered to it and assist in getting the permits. It knows there's an obligation, and under these circumstances, it knows it wasn't done. And really, the way the contractual provisions read, it seems clear that the landlord is anticipating liability under the circumstances, not just because it has assumed to itself the duties to make sure the permits and plans are complied with and obtained, but also because it's seeking indemnity from the operator. So what the district court did is say, if this is a joint obligation, a joint responsibility, a joint liability, the parties have delegated that only to the tenant. But that doesn't work.
Which permit are you saying they were required to get that they didn't, assuming that it was a duty on Bango Oil?
One of the things we brought up was the hot work permit, but I think that's a secondary issue. I think, and you know, the fight in the district court isn't whether there was a permit they were supposed to get, but they didn't get the permits. Even though they filed their original plans with Churchill County, they didn't get permits for the construction. And therefore, not only were there no inspections of the plans, there were no inspections of the actual building of the storage facility and the pipeline. So a government official, but a building permit or otherwise, detected that this was not built according to plan.
So it's the building permit that they failed to get that under 459.3829 is a duty of the owner to ensure that it was obtained. And because of that, your client can impose liability on the owner. That the theory?
And there were also, we haven't briefed what permits there are. They haven't contested that. What they do contest is whether they got permits. So we're looking at permits for the storage tank. We're looking at permits having through the state having to do with toxic materials. So although that has not been fully laid out, I really think that's an issue for respondents since they moved for summary judgment. They would have to prove the absence of issues. And what happened in the district court was they did try to say, look, we submitted no proof that there weren't permits. But the district judge did assume that permits were not obtained.
Okay. Well,
Mr. Polzenberg, Justice.
No. Go ahead, Justice Herndon.
Thank you. Mr. Polzenberg, with regard to those two permits, the hot work permit and the storage tank permit that you're putting forth should have been obtained by the owner, understanding that the accident occurred as a result of this asphalt flux pipeline, what's the evidence of causation of either of those permits related to the accident and the injuries that actually occurred?
Well, there are two aspects to that. Causation, it seems to be a minor issue in this case because the parties haven't really relied on that. I think the respondent has not proven that it would not have been prevented. And I say minor issue not because it is legally a minor issue, but because the parties didn't really fight on that ground. They fought on the duty ground. So I don't think they've established enough for causation. So I think I am entitled at the very least to the inference that if the proper permits had been obtained, that this condition would not have existed. Now, defendants raise another causation argument. They also say, well, look, this is all the result of the sloppy operations of the tenant. Well, that's not enough to grant summary judgment on causation. It reminds me of the Andrews versus Harley-Davidson case where Harley-Davidson came in and said, look, it's not a design defect or a product defect in our vehicle because the driver was DUI. And this court and the district court granted what was then 41B and met judgment as a matter of law. And this court reversed and said, no, that causation is irrespective of how somebody operates in light of a condition, as long as it's foreseeable, that somebody can't come in and say there isn't causation here, that there's a superseding intervening cause. So while the issues that Justice Kadish and Justice Herndon address, and they're good issues, they're really not major issues in this case. I don't think they were developed in the district court. They are hardly developed in the Supreme Court, and they weren't the basis of the district court's decision. The district court's decision was simply on duty. So I think duty arises both under the statute and under, aside from the, I mean, totally different from the contract being a way to delegate and avoid liability. I think the contract is a means to obtain liability here. Let me explain why. Because I really think that the duty issue, the premises liability issue, and the dangerous condition issue are all intertwined. They rely on Wright versus Shum to say landlords are not liable. Well, I mean, that's the theme of their case, but I think at the very best, it's imprecise. There are many situations where landlords aren't liable. Under Wright versus Shum, though, a landlord can be liable when it participates in a situation and assumes a duty. So I think that's what the contract does here. And whether it's under premises liability or negligence, and Justice Springer used to contend that those weren't really different things, but the where a party, a landlord, is involved with a tenant in an operation to the point where they are using both participating and using the threat of eviction, which is what is in the contract here. If the tenant fails to permit, fails to properly build, they can be evicted. When they participate to that degree, they are participating in the liability as well. And the ordinary concept of...
yeah, that was your 15 minutes.
Wow.
Time
flies when you're having fun.
Sure. Let me, I mean, I'll give you a minute on rebuttal and add another minute to respondents' time so you can at least hit any points you need to when you come back.
Justice Kadish, thank you very much.
Okay. All right. So, Mr. Poulos, is that how you say it?
Poulos, Your Honor.
Poulos. Okay. All right. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices. Good morning, Counsel. I represent, along with others here, Bango Oil. The dispute in this case, and I wanted to clarify a couple things up front. The facility is located at Bango Road out in Fallon in Churchill County. That is the only relationship between Bango Oil Company, my client, and Mr. Sodgrass's former employer, Bango Refining NV. There is no other relationship between the entities. So sometimes, as I'm sure the court's aware, sometimes related entities have different ownership interests. That's not the case here. There's literally no relationship between the parties. And in fact, at the time of this incident, as everyone is aware, there was a lease agreement. And this lease agreement also was an option to buy my client's LLC ownership interests. So the idea here was that over time, this would be paid and this facility would be owned by Bango Refining. At the time of the incident, and there's a lot of facts here that are not in dispute, so I do agree with Mr. Poulsenberg to some extent on that. And in his response to summary judgment and his complaint, Mr. Sodgrass concedes that Bango Oil, my client, had no right to use the facility. He concedes that he was an employee of Bango Refining. He concedes in the complaint, paragraph 15, that at all pertinent times, Bango Refining was permitted, duly permitted, and was the operator of the facility which he was injured. There is no evidence of any equipment manufacturer failure. There's no evidence of any design problem, and there's no evidence that my client did anything other than be the ground lease holder at the time of this incident. In other words, in December 9th of 2013, when this accident happened, it is undisputed that Daniel Sodgrass, while he was an employee of Bango Refining, was out on a very cold day with a weed wand, and he was trying to heat the slurry, the flux in the pipe. The evidence is that his co-worker flipped the switch incorrectly. That sent steam into the asphalt tank, which caused the pressure to rise in that tank. Everybody agrees, including Mr. Snodgrass, in response to summary judgment, that the tank functioned as designed and popped its top when the pressurized steam hit the burning hydrocarbons, and he was covered in tar, burning asphalt, basically. He was not wearing the appropriate clothing. He was not wearing fire-retardant clothing. And in all candor, he should not have been there when that happened. But those are problems that were created by his employer, Bango Refining. Mr. Snodgrass was candid in response to his summary judgment in saying that his choice was to either sue his employer for under the theory of gross negligence and tender back the almost $1 million in benefits he had received for this injury, or sue my client as well as the designer and the constructor of the steel tanks. Prior, Mr. Snodgrass voluntarily dismissed both those other entities. So the only party left in this case is my client. And as this court is aware, after a 3-hour argument on October 31st, 2018, Judge Draculich, in her 18-page opinion, granted summary judgment for my client. That ruling was appropriate in all respects. As the Huerta Court recently, which was the federal district court in Nevada, recently said, the Nevada Supreme Court has unambiguously held that once a lessee has taken possession of property, the landlord is not subject to liability to others coming onto land for physical harm caused by a dangerous condition on the premises. So here, and keep in mind that Mr. Snodgrass is not even a third-party invitee. He was an employee of the lessee. So he stands in the shoes from that perspective of the tenant. As the court is aware, and I believe it's at somewhere page 161 in the record, the tenant had the obligation to maintain and operate the premises, had the obligation to get all of the permits. And in response to that document, I'll come back to that in a second. But anyway, Nevada also follows the traditional common law rule that the lessor of land is not subject to liability to his lessee or others upon the land for physical harm caused by dangerous condition, which comes into existence after the lessee takes possession. And that's the Hughes case. And it is undisputed that this happened more than 2 years after the lessee came into possession of this property. So there was a reference to the Wright case and why they thought that somehow this the Wright supported an inference of liability here for my client. Absolutely not true. There's nothing that my client did, and there's no evidence. The sole evidence in this case is set forth in the declaration of Brad Ellie, which is at tab 26 in the record. And I'll talk to a little bit more about that, why I think the permits are a complete red herring. But for now, I will just finish. I want to talk about a couple what I think are some important issues. There was no affirmative conduct, no promises made by my client. In fact, the only evidence that relates to my client that is in the record before you is the ground lease. There are some, let me clarify that. There are some documents, in particular, investigations and memos from the state of Nevada saying that while my client did operate this in 2011, all permits were obtained and the facility appeared to be in compliance with both state and federal law.
I want to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying, because obviously this is different than the conversation we just had with Mr. Polzenberg. So are you saying that there's some conclusion by a government entity that all necessary permits were obtained?
I am saying that in May of 2011, when my client last had that,
I see.
And that's at record 840 in the appendix.
Thank you. Okay, so when they were operating it, they had the necessary permits, but that doesn't speak to what the tenant did or didn't do when it had control.
It doesn't, except that it's informative somewhat to this extent.
Okay.
From the document, from the lease document, you can tell that the tenant was going to expand existing facilities. If you look at the lease, Exhibit B, there are 15 permits that are required that we had to, and that we turned over to them. And also, you will see in Exhibit, in the lease document, and I believe it's 7.9 is the paragraph, everybody recognized that they were going to add some additional capacity to make this plant viable economically. In that provision, we specifically say, hey, some of these permits are held by the former operator. You need to go work this out, and then you need to go get whatever permits you need to get for your expansion. That was a contractual obligation between Mr. Snodgrass's employer and my client.
Well, but Mr. Polis, what do you say to Mr. Polzenberg's point that the lease requirements that the lessee get the permits and deliver them under penalty of eviction for failure to do so represents an undertaking consistent with Wright versus Shum that would impose liability?
Well, first of all, that was the Wright promise was from the landlord. What Mr. Polzenberg was referring to are promises that the tenant made to the landlord. And that's not unlike the agreement in the Hughes case where they said, well, you need to get our approval before you do any tenant improvements, not uncommon. And the district court there, based on this court's ruling, said that is not enough. And clearly it isn't, because there's no affirmative obligation on behalf of my client. Those are obligations on behalf of Mr. Snodgrass's client to undertake. And I would also say there's no penalty of eviction here. That's not what the agreement says. The agreement says you can be in default, and if you don't cure a default, then that is a provision that could ultimately lead to eviction. But there was a very detailed process for declaring a default if that had happened. And, of course, there's no evidence that that ever happened, Your Honor. This is just the agreement. There is no evidence that my client exercised any control whatsoever, particularly as it relates to this accident.
But it had the capacity, it had the contractual capacity to exercise a right of control. Your point is that that doesn't meet the right standard?
It does not.
Okay.
And in fact, the Hughes case, I think, deals with this issue expressly. And in particular, and I do want to talk a little bit, because they go on a lot in the brief about the non-delegable duty, about safety. And first of all, again, Hughes addressed this issue. If there's no duty in the first place, which we contend is the case here and what the court properly found, then there's nothing to talk about under the non-delegable duty doctrine. The second thing that I think is important with respect to that is that doctrine is an exception to an exception of the law. In other words, under respondeat superior, generally speaking, employees and agents that act within the course and scope of their employment, your employer is liable for those people. The use of independent contractors became prevalent, there was an exception to that. So if you're an independent contractor, you're not responsible. Well, the non-delegable duty doctrine came as an exception to the exception, so that if there are certain safety requirements, you can't get out of that by using an independent contractor. That doctrine has no application here because, A, there was no independent, no duty on my client's behalf. B, there was never any independent contractor involved in any of this. And C, this was not an injury to a third party invitee, but was an injury to the tenant himself by his employee.
So, Mr. Poulos, if I might, this is Justice Herndon. Moving away from the duty of care arguments, I wanted to ask you a question about the abnormally dangerous activity cause of action. In Judge Draculich's order at pages 15 to 17, when she discusses that, she seems to rely on other jurisdictions' general opinion that oil refining is not a dangerous activity. And then when examining the Valentine factors, seems to stop after talking about factor number 3 without any evaluation of the other factors, which is concerning because those factors are an and evaluation. You can't, it's not an or, so you don't just stop after one that applies and end of story kind of thing. So what is your position on whether there was a complete evaluation of that cause of action under Valentine.
Well, first, Your Honor, as it relates to this this case and this dispute, my clients were not engaged in any activity. They only owned the land. And so there is no ultra hazardous. If I think the court, it was in response to some briefing that I did on summary judgment, said that petroleum refining has never been found in any court that I'm aware of to be ultra hazardous. And in fact, the Anderson court supports, which is the Anderson versus Farmland 136 F sub second 1192, supports the theory that the third factor, which is the one that she stopped at, is the overriding factor under the restatement for determining whether something is abnormally dangerous. So I would submit, Your Honor, that that happens all the time. There was no evidence. The plaintiffs did not submit any evidence to support this ultra-hazardous or abnormally dangerous cause of action. The complaint is set forth of pages 1-6 on the record. It was spartan at best. The theory at trial and at summary judgment, in the litigation, was that my client was basically vicariously liable for the acts of the tenant, and that was set forth at paragraph 16 of the complaint. I do want to talk just briefly, with what time I have left, about the various permits. The hot work permit obviously doesn't apply. That's an OSHA requirement. It applies only to the employer. The tank permit also does not apply because it primarily applies to underground storage tanks and tanks between, I believe it's 110 gallons and 30,000 gallons. These tanks were much larger, and there's no evidence that that applied anyway. And third, the only requirement for permitting applies to only the operator. So even under their construction, that would be something that Bango Refining had to get, not my client. The bigger one that they spend most of the time on is the highly hazardous substances and explosives. And I will submit to this court that neither Bango Refining nor my client ever had to get that permit. And just so the court is aware, there is no agency or government saying that we needed a permit, that we're missing a permit. This is counsel's argument based on a subpoena that he submitted 13 days before the discovery cutoff. And he subpoenaed the state and said, well, I didn't get any of these permits back. And that was his opposition to summary judgment. And I would submit that was not effective. Under the Kuzey case, I'm not sure if I pronounced it right here, Nevada has adopted the Celotex standard. And once we, as we did in the summary judgment motion, filed our papers in question and said there's no evidence or as a matter of law, it was incumbent upon them to put forth this evidence. They did not do that. The final thing is I do want to address causation and the Vegas case. These permits, and there's a bunch of cases cited in our brief, support this. Even if we didn't have these permits, summary judgment was appropriate because they would have done nothing to prevent this accident. They don't bear on this accident at all, so there's no causation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Polzenberg, you have a minute for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. When it comes to permits, NRS Chapter 459 actually itself requires permits for storage tanks. And here the problem was the storage tank and the pipeline flowing through it. And the permit is from the State Division itself of Conservation and Natural Resources. Justice Herndon, thank you for bringing up abnormally dangerous. I think this ties in with the highly hazardous standard under Chapter 459. I agree the district court didn't properly analyze under Valentine, although she said we get the first two factors. She gave unusual weight to the third factor, didn't consider the other factors. I think the jury may have to figure that one out itself. And asphalt flux, the components of asphalt flux are highly hazardous under Chapter 459. Causation, it's simple. The tank was wrong, the flow line was wrong, designed to have a heat trace. They had to use a hand torch instead. That's what caused the accident. Thank you, Ron.
All right. Thank you very much, Council. Appreciate your advocacy here today. This matter will stand submitted, and we're in recess until our 11 o'clock.